apparent cause of death.
Amy Winehouse's blood alcohol content was nearly five times the legal limit when she died. The coroner's inquest heard there were three empty vodka bottles found in her bedroom. The court also heard Winehouse was battling her alcohol addiction. Her doctors said she just started drinking again after a period of abstinence. Although Winehouse had once been addicted to hard drugs, none was found in her system. The coroner's verdict, death by misadventure, that Winehouse suffered accidental alcohol poisoning. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Here's the latest from Wall Street. Dow Jones Industrial Average now up 60 points at 11,766. NASDAQ down 9. It's at 2630. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail.
Support comes from the U of I Coordinated Science Laboratory, celebrating 60 years of science with an open public lecture, The Coming Tipping Point in Robotics, with Mark W. Spong, Dean of Engineering at the University of Texas, on October 27th at 7:30 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum. Details at csl.illinois.edu/60.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this morning, Jason Croft. Janice Harrington is an award-winning poet and author of children's books. She's a storyteller and has worked as a public librarian. Somewhere along the way, she worked as a nurse's aide. That work provided her with the inspiration for her new book of poetry, The Hands of Strangers, Poems from the Nursing Home. Here she writes of the people she knew and cared for. She says it is a difficult topic, but a compelling one, a topic that deserves our attention. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will.com/talk@illinois.edu. Janice Harrington is the author of the poetry collection Even the Hollow My Body Made Is Gone, and the children's books The Chicken Chasing Queen of Lamar County and Going North. Her children's books were published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Her books of poetry are published by Boa Editions Limited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. And let me mention, too, that our guest this afternoon, October 21st, 2011, at 4:30, will be at the Illini Union Bookstore. Janice Harrington will do a reading. The bookstore is located at 809 South Wright Street in Champaign. That's 4:30 this afternoon. Janice, good to see you.
Oh, good to see you as well. Thank you, Celeste.
So when did you work as a nurse's aide?
I started actually when I was in high school. That was roughly, it'd be roughly the years 1974 to about 1978. I worked my way through college as well.
And where was this?
This would be in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Lincoln, Nebraska.
And I worked at two nursing homes. One was a private home and one was the public county home.
Couple of questions here. What were the days like for those you cared for, and what were they like for you?
It depended upon which institution they were in. In the private home, amazingly, where sons and daughters had paid a considerable sum to have their parents cared for, you would be surprised about how the same every day was. Some would wake up at 6 o'clock. We'd get them up, or 7 o'clock, get them up. They would have breakfast, and it would be the same breakfast 365 days a year. There wasn't an exercise program in that particular home. So it was sitting in your room. It was watching television. It was sleeping. It might be a visitor now and then. It might be someone taking you to a doctor's appointment, but the days were sadly monotone, right?
Yeah.
And for me as a nurse's aide, it was the schedule. It's shifts. You know, when you work the day shift, there's a certain time that you, there's certain residents that you're going to get up at a certain time, and they may be sitting in the hall waiting for breakfast, which could have been, I don't remember so much now, but let's say breakfast could have been around 8 or 9. They would be sitting that whole time in their wheelchair waiting for someone to take them down to the dining room. And so there are days when you give baths. There are days when you wash the wheelchairs. There are days. So it shifts. And then I worked day shift for a while, which was the hardest shift, and the night shift, which, again, it's a matter of routine. You do your bed check at 11, another bed check at 3, and you do what needs to be done.
And what about interactions between staff and the people who are living there?
I think what's important to know is that this was in the 70s. So in the nursing homes had horrific scandals in the 60s. There were legislations that were passed in the 70s, but still we're not in an enlightened time at all. So I think there might have been laws in the book that as a nurse's aide, I should just have been taking care of 6 residents at a time. But the reality was, 20 or an entire floor. So there wasn't time to, there's not time to sit down and have a conversation with somebody. Maybe in the course of giving somebody a bath or bathing them, maybe something is said, or maybe you get to know some of them, and so then there's something there. But generally, it was getting the job done, doing what the next thing was.
Mm. I would like you to read the first poem in this book, The Hands of Strangers. I think it's a perfect opening poem. It's called
Bed Checks. Mm-hmm. Bed Checks. 3 o'clock a.m., hunched small beneath cotton blankets, curled behind metal guards, they sleep at last. The barber sleeps and dreams of nicks and razors. The bus driver sleeps and the cow-hipped bearer of 13 children sleeps. The porter sleeps in the room with the birth defect. The Huntington's Korea sleeps on her padded floor. The teacher, the painter of greeting cards, the one-legged vet, all sleep. The farm widow dreams of silos and 7 gaunt and skinny cows swallowing 7 sleek and fatted cows. The woman, beaten for years by her husband, finally sleeps. The dementia sleeps and wakes, sleeps and listens for a ship, hearing its sails and querulous gulls. But it's only the chattering of our laundry carts, the scuff of our crepe soles moving from room to room as we go and slowly go, handmaids, vestals, novices, into the ward to bless each sleeper in turn. Oh, how quiet they breathe, the little children in their cradles. How easily they dream and prefer dreaming. Let nothing disturb them. Not the bedpan, not a shifting sheet, not our steps, not our mumbled talk, not the towels folded and unfolded, not the soap, not the running water, not pills toppling into a paper cup, not the water pitcher or its melting ice, not the traffic on L Street, not the dawn coming through wards of light, the dawn coming through concussions of light beneath a wounded sky. Let them sleep.
That's the poem Bed Checks from Janice Harrington's latest collection of poetry, The Hands of Strangers, Poems from the Nursing Home. I think it's a perfect opening poem because it has the people who are there and it has the staff and that kind of dance that they do. And also, it one of the questions that I have been confronted with in visiting nursing homes is, to the residents, who are you and who were you?
At that time, when I was just a high school girl, I knew nothing. I knew nothing. And my mother actually took me to my first nursing home, and she told them that I was a good girl. And I was trained by one of the aides that worked there, and this was a girl who came from a reform school, and she was very rough. And so it's interesting because my sister has just received her nurse's aide's license, and there was training. And I'm talking to her, and she had to be tested. And she told me that there was one question on that test that she had missed. It was about how to ambulate the elderly. And I'm going, what's to know? You just walk beside them. So it's like it's the difference between how times have changed, that she had that training and I didn't. So I go into a nursing home, no training at all, and I'm trained by not the best person at all. So impatient. I remember when I had to walk someone from their room to the dining room, it felt like it took a century. And the trick I learned was to spell the word patience over and over in my head with each step that they took. So I was young, knew nothing about human beings, knew nothing about what it would feel like to be old, what it felt like from their side. They were the job I had to get done, and I didn't see that human component. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you grow, you get wiser, you know something about the human heart, the human body. And I think if I went back now, it would be a different person. Yeah. Doing the work.
So you were spelling out the word patience, as in patience is a virtue.
Right, being patient, being
yes.
patient,
slow down.
P-A.
Be in this space.
Right.
Be mindful
right.
of the task.
Right, right. But it was hard to learn to adjust myself as a young person to these older bodies and learning how to help them and to be gentle in the way that they need.
Yeah. What's led your sister into this work?
She's a caring person and always has been. She's very empathetic and wants to give. And so this seems to be the work for her.
Yeah. My experience has been that there are, you know, people who are there doing this work because they can and they have to mm-hmm. make a living. Mm-hmm. And others, though, are really, truly blessed mm-hmm. With a gift for caring for people.
I definitely encountered, especially in the county home, women who were angels, though it sounds cliche, is literally what they were. They were incredibly caring and giving and kind. Treated everyone with a gentleness that you could aspire to. And then there were others, as you say, at that time, literally you could walk into a nursing home, fill out the form, and be hired. And that brought with it all of the horror stories that you can imagine. People just coming in off the street
yeah.
who just want a job. And it paid, at that time, it wasn't minimum wage, it was just a little bit above minimum wage. And you, when I went to the county home, I had the opportunity, I could work my way up, get a little training, and become a med aide and get paid more. But there was a variety of people in the nursing home that worked there that I encountered. Working women who had to support their family. I remember one young woman, she was a single mother. I remember her story very well. There was girls who came in off the reservation. There were new immigrants often there, typically working class, typically high school education only. So in that regard, when I was working my way through college, I was the oddball, you know. But so it was people had to put food on the table and they became nurse's aides.
Yeah. When did the point come when you no longer had to spell out that word patience every day?
If it had to, I don't know that ever went away. You learn the job, the job shapes you. You learn the pace of it, and I think also switching to the night shift helped a lot because then it's not that rapid pace of the day shift. People who work the day shift work incredibly hard because it's not just taking care of the residents, but you know, and giving the baths. But at one nursing home, it was literally washing the wheelchairs. You have to make the beds, change the beds. You're constantly doing that, dragging materials to the laundry. There's like an entire layer of activities you have to do, the heavy lifting. The night shift is a much quieter pace, of course, because primarily they're sleeping, so you're just doing bed checks. But what they do then at this particular home where I worked is that they would add busy work because they wanted to make sure we stayed busy. So we cleaned the juice machine, we defrosted the refrigerator, those sorts of things on the night shift.
Yeah. This is Focus, our guest this morning, Janice Harrington. Her latest collection of poetry is The Hands of Strangers, poems from the nursing home. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. While working as a nurse's aide, were you writing? I mean, back in when you first started, you were very young in high school. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, I would have imagined you to have always been a reader, mm-hmm. and someone interested in stories and storytelling. I was wondering if you were writing at the time.
No, in college I fell in love with poetry, and for a moment there, I was writing all the time, but I didn't write about my nursing home experiences. It didn't occur to me. But the years go by, and you have so many life experiences, and once I started writing again, I began to realize I still remembered all of the people that I worked with. I remember their illnesses. I remember interactions with them. I remember things that we were taught, and I realized I was haunted, and I started to get those on paper. I think the first poem that I tried to write when we turned to the subject, which was in the 1990s, I was always struck when I was an aide, when I would see the bodies of old women, the scars that they had. They would have fingers missing because they got washing dishes and a knife slip. They would have double mastectomies. Older women's bodies, obviously, because I'm young, were striking to me. They were this canvas of absences. And so the first poem I wrote was trying to talk about that. I wasn't able to say what I wanted to say, but that was that first effort to try to get some of these stories and write about them. And because it was finally coming to realize there's some poetry here. These things are in your mind for a reason, your memory for a reason. Let's deal with these ghosts.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting that on the one hand, yes, the hands of strangers, but yet there are so many intimacies mm-hmm. shared. Mm-hmm. You are bathing mm-hmm. someone. Mm-hmm. You are feeding them. Maybe you're holding their hand. Mm-hmm. You're making sure that they get down the hallway right. safely. Right. Maybe you have a moment to look at the photographs mm-hmm. that are on mm-hmm. their nightstand.
Yeah, we were busy. And one of the things that I like to do when there was time is, you know, if you could help groom someone, help brush their hair or comb their hair or do a little extra, help them put their makeup on, make them look pretty. The aides would, when there were those sorts of spaces, that was one of the pleasures, seeing this human relationship start to blossom. And I remember in the private home in the evening after everything was done, sometimes the aides would play cards with the old men, and the old men would beat us badly. It was humiliating, but we would come together and there'd be this laughter and this pleasure over the cards or putting someone in there, you know, they would have a company coming, so getting them dolled up and getting their best house dress on them and making them look pretty. Those were the good moments when you could see someone smile. Or it didn't make it into the book, but one of the lovely love stories in the home, there was a gentleman, he was a war veteran. He had one leg, he was cut off below the knee. There was another woman, she was in a wheelchair, she had diabetes, and they developed a relationship with each other. So the aides would arrange that they could have some private time and we wouldn't go near their room. And so those were, you know, there were good human things.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you said about remembering. Mm-hmm. Memory and remembering are clearly important to you. Mm-hmm. When were you first aware of that?
Maybe always. I think it's something that is valued in my family. We talk a lot about passing things down. My grandmother saved things. She passed them down. My mother saves things, passed them down. And it was always something that you just took in by osmosis that you honored and you'd paid attention to the past, family history. And memory is just one of my resources as, you know, as a writer. And you mentioned, was I writing in high school? I guess I should say when I started writing on this book, you can't, memory only takes you so far. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing research, and I kept a diary all through those years. So I was going through these boxes of old diaries looking for, did I say anything about what was going on at work? And I only found one little squib, and it was about a woman who had died in the home. And I used that anecdote to create a poem.
And is that the...
May Ingalls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, let's delve into the poem then. Okay. That is a wonderful epigraph that you used to get into to the poem, and I was going to ask you if indeed that was your words.
Right.
There.
It was funny. I found old the old pages from the nurse's notes that I had used to write things on, but nothing about the work other than this one little moment. It's called May Ingalls. The epigraph. May Ingalls died yesterday. No family, no friends, no possessions. Just a room provided by the county. No pastor, no nurses, no anything. No book will ever give her a sentence. August 11th, 1977. May Ingalls died, and she died of scurvy. May Ingalls died, and she died of sorrow. May Ingalls died, and she died like this. Oh, 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 oh. May Ingalls died, or maybe she didn't. Tomorrow, ring bells, burn effigies of crones. Declare it May Ingalls Day. Let mothers name their babies May or Ingalls. Let astrologers rename Orion's belt and call it May Ingalls Garter. Let believers see her face on mildewed wallpaper in a day's inn in Biloxi. Let biologists name a newly discovered orchid May Ingalls, or a moth, or a deep-sea squid not seen since the Pleistocene era. Let poets write in the form of May Ingalls, small and plain and common. May you travel with 30 other pilgrims to find her grave, but not finding it, may you open a boutique to sell May Ingalls memorabilia and sack lunches to tourists who want to lie in the county bed where May Ingalls died. May you live out your days as happy as May Ingalls. May you whisper before pressing your tongue against the slope of your beloved's neck, May Ingalls, oh, May Ingalls. May Ingalls plucked the feathers of the last Lord God bird. She is the nude on the far right in Cézanne's Les Grandes Babous. Yesterday, anthropologists discovered the image of a small woman leaping amidst a herd of antelope. They have called her May Ingalls. May Ingalls has 7 overdue library books. Below your right kidney, the doctor will find proof of May Ingalls. Yes, you are in good health. On a playground in Alabama, black girls clap their hands. They've made a rhyme for May Ingalls. Oh, May Ingalls, Ingalls, looks like shingles, Ingalls. Her bones go jingle, Ingalls. Her toenails tingle, Ingalls. Your daddy stole a pudding, Ingalls. He made your mama cry, Ingalls. Now they're gonna hang him on the 4th of July. The water laps May and May against the shore. The earth answers, and the wind, and the boy swinging his toes above the dock, all with the same glad syllable, May and May and May. Afterward, the boy will snatch a fish from the dark water. He'll split its belly and find a golden ring. Lifting the ring, he'll cry, May Ingalls! Some say a small woman now stands beside death. She touches those whom death chooses. She lifts the dead from their tangled veins as if their bodies were beds they lay in for too long. Some say that before dying, if you whisper the woman's name, death will slow, surprised that you remember a woman without family or monument or possession. Death will slow, and you will have a moment, and maybe another moment more. May Ingalls. May Ingalls. May Ingalls.
So now May Ingalls has a poem.
Yeah, I think when I finished that poem, it was one of the last ones I made for the book. I suddenly felt, yes, this is why the book. I wanted to remember these lives, and I wanted them to go forward.
Hmm. What do you think about the way so many come to the end of their lives without a line being written?
I guess, you know, in a way, we're all heading in that direction. What it points out maybe is that it's the care that you receive while you're here, the love that you receive while you're here, the attention that you receive while you're here, that someone recognizes your humanity while you're here. And that's what I want for the elders who are in institutionalized care, someone who sees and recognizes their humanity and who's gentle with them, listens to them, talks to them, cares about them. I can't imagine a greater loneliness than being isolated in a nursing home, and someone to reach in through that loneliness and touch you. And that's what has to be done.
Yeah. Lessons for all of us here. Patience.
Yeah.
Being one of them.
Right.
When and how did you begin to write that poem, May Ingalls? Was it with that little scrap you found in the diary?
Yeah, that's exactly.
And then and then through that scrap of paper, did how she look and how she...
I remember May Ingalls. She was very memorable because she was the shortest woman I'd ever seen. She was like a little toy. My grandmother was as small as May was. She was very small, and she had a skin condition. I don't know what it was, but she, her skin was so dry, so dry, so dry. And I remember once I was trying to be nice. You know, I bathed her and I put lotion all over her body, thinking I would solve this problem. It was just dry skin. Well, it wasn't. You know, the next day she was still just as dry and coated with dust. And she would sit in her chair, and she was so short her legs would just swing in the air. And that's all I know about her, really. I mean, I remember her swinging in the chair. I remember how small she was and her skin. And then when she died, there was just nobody there. It was... you know, one day she's there and the next day there's an empty bed.
Yeah.
And so in writing the poem, I just let my imagination go. I just, what are all the things that May Ingalls could be? And I don't even remember how she died. I put scurvy and I don't want anybody to think she died of scurvy. She didn't. That was just imaginative play there. But, the poem went on and on forever. I just had fun. And then somewhere... by itself, the poem suggested that May Ingalls is now standing with death, and now, you know, one of his helpers, and the poem sort of started writing itself at that point.
Yeah, a helper or a preventer?
I saw her maybe as both. That if you knew who she was, then you'd get a few seconds, you know, to be alive a little bit longer. But ultimately. You know, you're going to be lifted out of your body. That's her job.
Maybe to go on to do a rhyme with May Ingalls and skip rope.
Right.
Who knows?
That'd be great.
So did this poem turn in your mind over time, or did it kind of come together quickly?
Oh, no, nothing I write ever comes together quickly. I wish I could have that experience.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it was many, many weeks of polishing, and it was longer. It was shorter. It went all over the place, and finally came down to what it is now. Just what you know, and at the same time, even though I'm talking about her, I'm also talking about me. You know, the fact that she has these overdue library books.
The librarian.
The librarian came out, and so you bring in parts of your life and parts of her life and make a poem.
Yeah, I want to go back and explore memory a little bit mm-hmm. more. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that memory. The purpose of poetry mm-hmm. can be to remember.
Right.
Going way back in our history as human beings, that's how we remembered mm-hmm. things and mm-hmm. told mm-hmm. one another what happened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So have you given that any thought?
For me, memory is... It's a way of... taking the things I love or care about or that I'm haunted by and using memory to preserve them in language. Memory is, you know, it's that form of history. It's that moment, that it's that method of bearing witness. Memory is how I bear witness, how I say, this is what happened. I want you to look at it. I want you to think about it. I don't know what you'll do with it, but it feels more like a practice that's integral to my life and being that I have to do.
Yeah. It's also a way to, when you remember something, you can revisit it.
Oh, definitely.
And you can say, let me think about that
right.
some more.
Right, right. There's an African folk tale about a man who dies, and everyone forgets him but his youngest son. And his youngest son grows up, and his first words are, "Where's my father?" Which makes everybody go, "Oh, yeah, what happened to him?" So they go looking, they find his bones, they bring him back to life. And the end of the story, the message of the story is that no man is truly forgotten, no man is truly dead until he is forgotten. And I think that's also a way that I look at things, that this experience is not dead as long as I remember it. You know, it's still something I can draw on.
Hmm. This is Focus. Our guest this morning, Janice Harrington. She's an award-winning poet and author of children's books. She's a storyteller and has worked as a public librarian. Somewhere along the way, as we learned, she worked as a nurse's aide beginning in high school, and then she worked her way through college as a nurse's aide. And that work provided her with the inspiration for her new book of poetry, The Hands of Strangers, Poems from the Nursing Home. The book is published by Boa Editions Limited. This afternoon at 4:30, today is October 26, 2011. This afternoon at 4:30 at the Alana Union Bookstore, Janice Harrington will do a reading. The bookstore located at 809 South Wright Street in Champaign. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you this morning. Join us with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll have more with Janice Harrington after a short break.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Charleston Community Theater, presenting Lifetimes 3 this Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Tarbell Arts Center in Charleston. Seating is limited. Reservations can be made at 581-2787 or online at charlestoncommunitytheater.org.
This is Focus. Janice Harrington is our guest this morning. She's an award-winning poet and author of children's books. She's a storyteller as well. Her latest book, The Hands of Strangers, Poems from the Nursing Home. My name is Celeste Quinn, our technical director, Jason Croft. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Where and when did the desire to write poetry hit you?
It was in college. I saw the play For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough, and I started writing then. I had an English teacher at that time, and an English professor, and I so wish I remember her name, of all the things to have lost, I lost that because I would give her my poems. It was an African-American literature class, and I don't know why, but I would bring her a sheath of my poems, and all she would do is put a little check mark in the corner of the one she liked. I didn't know why she liked it. I didn't know why she didn't check some other than others, but it kept me writing. I just kept writing and bringing her poems, and she just kept these little check marks. And I still have those poems with the little check marks. But, you know, life happens. You reach that point where you think, oh, no one will ever read my work. No one will ever publish me. And so I put it aside. I became a teacher, then a librarian, and writing was the farthest thing from my mind. And then in the 90s, I had a children's program, a poetry workshop for fifth graders. And Mike Madonick from campus here came and did this workshop. And I wrote a poem, though this was for the children. I wrote a poem and gave it to him. And he did just the worst possible thing you could do. He praised it. And I went home and I wrote. I mean, I remember writing like all night long and not stopping. It wasn't that they were good poems. It was the writing. It was like of the volcano exploding, the bottle cap coming off the Coke that had been shaken too much. It just all spews out. So I started writing then, and I didn't stop. And I do think, you know, what would have happened if I hadn't done the workshop, you know, and if he hadn't appraised that poem. It just sort of shows you how dreams can slip away from you so easily.
Yeah, yeah. It was sort of a rebirth of that little check mark.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, yeah, that's terrific. Now, when did the children books come along?
The adult poetry came first.
Okay.
Then I wrote a poem that became Going North. And Going North did well. And so then The Chicken Chasing Queen of Lamar County, which was a very easy book to do because I was an inveterate criminal chicken chaser when I was a kid. So, in fact, when I told my mother the title over the telephone long distance, she said, "That's you." You know, 'cause I didn't. All she had to do was hear the title, and she knew immediately what the book was about.
I love this book, by the way. I have it here in the studio. We had it. We talked about it some time back when it first came out, and it's just so much fun to read read aloud.
Yeah,
you got to read it aloud. We have an email. Question, comment. Someone is writing in to say, "I just wanted to say that though I dabble in writing, I've never much cared for poetry. Your poem about May Engels, however, sent shivers up my spine."
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. It's a beautiful tribute to someone whom I'm sure deserves to be remembered.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. And no excuses now. You have to write.
There you go.
Lots of poetry.
There you go. You might be capable of sending shivers up somebody else's spine.
Yeah, we all are.
Yeah. I wanted to go now to something that you said about poetry. This was an interview, Poetry Society of America, Q&A. Mm-hmm. And you were asked, "Do you think that your poetry or poetry in general speaks to spiritual or religious yearnings and struggles? Mm-hmm. If so, how?" And you answered, "Poetry is a means of paying attention." Mm-hmm. "But to what do we attend? An inner spirit, the unseen, the questions we want to ask but know that we will never answer. Or maybe poetry is simply a means of shouting back, raising a fist before the face of an immense, unknown, and unseemingly dispassionate mystery that surrounds our daily lives." And as an example of that, you said to the interviewer, take The Thief's Tabernacle, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. What were you talking about there in terms of this poem? And maybe you'd elaborate on what you were saying here, and then read the poem. And this poem comes from the collection...
Even the Hollow, My Body Made Is Gone, right? Faith is one of those large topics. It's a topic that poets, writers, songwriters, all of us have wrestled with on a day-to-day basis. And for me, like I said, it is paying attention to the world that we are in, using our senses, looking at what's here. And it's our privilege and our duty to do that as human beings, to move through the day mindful of what's around us and what we're seeing, and of course, each other. The Thief's Tabernacle has an epigraph, which is really very beautiful. I'm stealing the golden vessels of the Egyptians to build a tabernacle to my God from them, far, far away from the boundaries of Egypt. If you forgive me, I shall rejoice. If you are enraged with me, I shall bear it. Johannes Kepler. If I steal the wan light from these penitent clouds and take from their pewter cups dull coins of rain, if I plunder, somewhere there's music, how faint the tune, somewhere there's heaven, how high the moon, and lift the rifle crack rifts of calving icebergs and pinch plastic wads from the bellies of white-tailed deer, if I purloin protons, all the negative numbers and seven of Cantor's infinities, if the world's sweetness drips from my lips, syrupy, nectarous, honey wine cascades of sweetness between full lips, if I steal distance, the shifting sandhills, and every syllable of Susquehanna, sultry and solitude, if I am stealthy and sly, and despite securities, spider over the ledge to burgle and leave you like the echo of a man weeping in an abandoned house, if I steal your gray-haired fear, the way you wake each night to worry, if I finger the last morning-lit moment, seconds before you swing your legs to step into it, will you forgive me? Faith is avarice. Doubt covets. I build a house for us. Rejoice. I think in my meditations about faith and belief, I begin to see that by wanting to believe, by wanting a larger structure for your soul and for your heart and for your life, that was a form of greed. Faith is greed. Faith wants everything, all the good stuff, everything. But and doubt, if you doubt, if you say, I don't believe in that, there's no providence, there's no higher voice, no higher moral authority, that doubting is actually a coveting, a wanting to know more, wanting it to be there. So I that's where that poem came from. Just it was a sort of a meditation of faith, and also I literally wanted to use the poem to steal all the things I found interesting and put them in one poem.
And when you set out to write a poem like that, it seems to me that in some ways you're on a search.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking for the right words, mm-hmm. you're looking for the right metaphors,
right.
you're looking for the right rhythm.
Right.
You're looking for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how that unfolds?
A good morning for me, you know, I've been writing all morning long because I wake up really early, and maybe at noon I realize I've changed one word in a poem, and I'm so happy. I'm overjoyed. It feels like a great accomplishment. So it's coming back to the poem again and again, reading it, rereading it, thinking about it. These poems begin to feel like people I know. You know, they start walking and talking and saying things to me, and I use that to try to help shape them. But it's what every poet knows. You pay attention to every word. Is it the right one, the right sound, the right meaning? And I love chasing a word back through dictionaries and etymologies to find out all the different meanings.
Interesting. We got a new dictionary in the mail the other day, and it came with some magnets, to advertise it. And I really kind of like the ad campaign that they're running. It's You are your words.
Oh.
That's the slogan.
I like that.
I like it too.
Yeah.
It's too bad that there's all this advertising around it.
But
a dictionary is a good thing. They should sell those.
Well, one of my best possessions, my greatest possessions, is one of those old-fashioned, unabridged. I got it from the library when the library was weeding things that weren't being used. This dictionary must weigh as much as a small Volkswagen, and it has all these words in it. But the thing that always amazed me is that I will die, and there will be words in my own language that I've never used, never encountered, never explored. And just thinking about that, you know, it's... Forget going to the moon. Forget going to the bottom of the sea. I haven't even explored the boundaries of my own language, you know.
So There's a reason to get up out of bed every morning.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Let's take a call. This is a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi, you're on the air with Janice Harrington.
Yes, I'm afraid I was driving and rather distracted by traffic. I was wondering if you could repeat again what you were saying from that poem of how you viewed faith, and just repeat that, please. It was very interesting.
Oh no! Okay, I will try to reconstruct. I think I was at the end of the poem. It says, "Faith is avarice, doubt covets," and I was thinking that faith is really a form of greed because you want everything. You want there to be a God. You want there to be moral authority. You want all the riches and wealth of the universe and all the things promised. Faith is a form of greed. And I saw doubt when you're not sure about those things, when you question that still you still want them. You're still coveting. It's there's some envy in that doubt. So that's what I was thinking at the time of the poem. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, sure. The definition of faith is I think that's one of the most interesting words, the way that different people define it and use it in our culture, mm-hmm. and the way it means different things to different people. It's very interesting. To some, it means, you know, a rock certain. Rock steady certainness about what they know, and to others it seems to mean that to me it seems to mean more just a trust that things will be okay, mm-hmm. and not necessarily a certainty about what things are. It's mm-hmm. it's just I don't claim I'm not trying to disagree with your interpretation. It's interesting how differently it's interpreted mm-hmm. and how people feel about the word.
Oh, absolutely. So, get 100 people here and they'll all have 100 different definitions. It's a big topic.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us and talk with poet Janice Harrington this morning, give us a call, 217-333-9455. So that's the local number, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Have you written poetry for children?
I have tried to write poetry for children. It is difficult. It is extremely difficult to write for children. The closest I've come actually is through my picture books. So if you look at Going North, that is essentially a poem that's been turned into a picture book. But Shel Silverstein, who I admire, adore, he's one of the great icons of children's poetry, unfortunately has also made it so that poetry for children has become about rhyme and about being very funny and about sort of easy topics. So Shel Silverstein, of course, is dead, but if he were alive, I'd have a bone to pick with him, you know. But it's a challenge, even for me. It's an incredible challenge to write for kids.
Are there books out there you admire from poets who have written for children?
I love Honey, I Love by Eloise Greenfield. It's one of my favorites. There is Shel Silverstein, Jack Prelutsky, if you want what's humorous and if you want what's funny. Gary Soto's Neighborhood Odes is, you know, it's an old classic, but it's lovely, lovely, lovely. There's one other person whose name is escaping me, but I would say if you want recommendations of children's poetry, by all means, call your local children's librarians. I've been out of the game for about 4 years now, but they are the people who can tell you where the good stuff is and how to find it.
Yeah. What's your experience as a librarian and you personally growing up? When is the time when kids turn away so much from the children's department and wander into adult, what we call adult, mm-hmm. adult works?
When do they start reading adult books?
Yeah.
It depends on the child. I mean, some are very precocious. But for the most part, the kingdom of children's books is a wondrous place for children to be. And finding books like Holes by Lewis Sosher or, yes, Harry Potter or any of the wonderful books of childhood, to getting our kids to read as much as possible, to read more, that's how you get the next generation of poets. And so I want, as we all do, we want our kids reading. There's a lot of competition now. The computer screen, the television screen, the iPod, the text. So being excited about books, being excited about poetry is how we're going to get our next writers, and we all have a responsibility to do that.
Yes, as a librarian, who I think of librarians also as teachers, mm-hmm. Did you, in your work with kids, did you use music? Did you use dance? Did you use movement? Because I think that that's part and parcel of poetry and of writing. I mean, clearly it is so much happening in the chicken-chasing
right.
queen of Lamar County.
The great thing about being a children's librarian, the reason it's one of the best careers out there, is that, yes, I did all of those things to try to get children excited about language and about reading, especially during our preschool story hours. And if you're looking for one of the best-kept secrets, it's the preschool story hours that are going on every day at your local libraries where kids sing, dance, read books, hear stories, puppets, the whole universe of what's available.
Play games, mm-hmm, play word mm-hmm. games.
Everything.
Yeah, it is good. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up.
Oh, thank you
for
having me.
The time has gone so quickly.
I appreciate it.
I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning here on Focus. Janice Harrington has been our guest. She's an award-winning poet and author of children's books. And her latest book is The Hands of Strangers, Poems from the Nursing Home. She's also the author of the poetry collection Even the Hollow My Body Made Is Gone. Those books are published by Boa Editions Limited. And we've also talked a little bit this morning about the chicken-chasing queen of Lamar County. I just love saying that title. And Going North. Those books are published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And later today, October 26th, 2011, Janice Harrington will be at the Alani Union Bookstore. That's this afternoon at 4:30. She'll do a reading. The bookstore is located at 809 South Wright Street in Champaign, and everyone is invited to attend.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you so much, Janice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org.
It is 1 minute before noon Central Time. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Time for our look at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat is trading at 719, down 14 and a half. March, 732 and a half, down 15. December wheat, Chicago, 619, down 17 and a quarter. March, 657, down 15 and three quarters. December corn, 635 and three quarters, down 15. March, 648, down 14 and a quarter. May, 654, down 13 and three quarters. July, 657 and a half, down 13 and three quarters. November soybeans, 1211 and a half, down 14. January, 1220 and three quarters, down 13. March, 1230, down 13 and a half. May, 1238, down 13 and a quarter. December soybean meal, 317.90. That is down 4.30. The December oil contract, 50.83, down 67. October live cattle, 122.15, up a nickel. December up a nickel at 122.02 and a half. November feeder cattle 142.72 1/2, up 92.5. December lean hogs 87.27 1/2, up 57.5. December crude oil 91.36. That's down.